Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along with us today. We will be talking about bugs and insects in this hour with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab in Madison. And for people who wish to see a picture of various insects to identify them, you can go to their website. At the department's website is entomology.wisc.edu/insect-id. That's, again, entomology.wisc.edu/insect-id. And we'll find out more about these insects. I didn't realize it, but there are a group of insect ambassadors from the University of Wisconsin who are available to travel to local schools, clubs, and organizations to give interactive presentations about insects and related arthropods. Purpose of the program to teach members of the audience about insects and related arthropods. Purpose of the program is to, as I say, teach members about insects, where they live, how they survive, and the positive things they do for our environment. In addition to presenting live and preserved arthropods, insect ambassadors provide facts and fascinating stories throughout the program, or through the program. Insect ambassadors hope to stimulate children and adults to learn and seek out information. And that's available when you go on the website and look at Insect Ambassadors. And I believe we've got Phil Pelletieri on the phone with us today. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Sorry about the mix-up.
That's all right. That's okay. What are the most frequent insects that you're seeing in the lab these days for identification?
Well, I hate to say it, but it's bed bugs. I mean, to some sense, the frenzy in the media is such that I am seeing people that are kind of paranoid and don't have bed bugs and think they do. But the other side, in reality, is that probably is the most common thing. The other thing we see at this time of the year is critters in pet food and in people food, noodles, that kind of thing. A lot of the grain beetles and the moths are really quite common.
Mm-hmm. If you'd like to join the conversation, all you have to do is give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I was very interested in a story that I saw in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about tarantulas and how they're helping scientists map how human beings process fear. And they're using an 8.5-inch long Brazilian salmon pink tarantula because this spider species is supposedly responsible for one of the most common phobias in human beings. Are you aware of this kind of research that's been going on?
Well, in general, I think spiders give most of us the heebie-jeebies, and I do know of research even with chimpanzees and the like that it almost is an innate fear. I mean, it really is quite interesting. And even with all the work that I do with insects, you know, if the spider's out in front of me and whatnot, I'm okay. But if it surprises me and it's big, I jump just like everybody else.
They have a test where you take your shoe off and your sock off, if you have one, and you put your shoeless foot into a box, which is connected to five other boxes. And as the tarantula approaches your box, your brain goes from anxiety to panic. And in reality, in the test, there's no spider, there's video of a spider approaching.
Well, I can very much relate to that. As I said, I think, I don't know if it's all of us growing up watching too much science fiction or whatnot, but I think it's, you know, and in our climate in particular, I mean, we have some moderate-sized spiders, but nothing really huge. And so, as I said, it's just so much a fear involved of anything that large, even though in many cases those things are really very gentle. And, you know, we have a lot of people that keep tarantulas as pets.
Are tarantulas able to survive in Wisconsin?
No, not outdoors at all. And I mean, there are parts in the southeast and in southwest where you can run into tarantulas, but not up in this climate. But, you know, indoors, as I said, there's a handful of species that have been worked up in the pet trade, and people keep them. In fact, it's quite common for us here on campus when students are graduating and they've had a pet tarantula, rather than taking it with them, they often donate to the museum upstairs.
Uh-huh. Apparently the result of this research is that the fear responses will break down if we understand them well enough, and that if you have a a fairly moderate toleration of these kinds of insects and spiders, why then you're probably going to be okay. But if you have that real fear, then I suppose that, you know, panic sets in.
And one of the things I was always interested in, we had a pet tarantula, and tarantulas have personalities, and some of them are just very docile. And we were going out doing a high school recruitment type things where high school students would come by and we'd talk. We'd offer for people to let the tarantula walk on them. And what I found very interesting, the takers were probably 70% women. They were far more tolerant of the tarantula than the young men.
I also was just noticing that article on your website there about the Insect Ambassadors Program. Is that been going on for some time? Because I hadn't heard of it before.
Yes, and it really started to give an opportunity both to our undergrads and graduate students to get out in the classroom. And, you know, we do get a lot of schools requesting that, and so it was a way of kind of servicing that need. But the other side is we always try to get the students, aside from getting them comfortable talking in front of groups, is that, I mean, insects are a really easy sell for young people in particular, and so the kids usually get very enthusiastic about it, and the students get a great experience at the same time. In fact, now one of our recently past members of our department, Chuck Koval, was nice enough to put up funds to help support the Insect Ambassadors.
Now, this, as I'm looking at, this was a summer session activity. Do these go on all year round?
Yes, it's kind of, you know, to be honest, I still don't think they can fill all the requests they get, and it has to stay somewhat localized to Madison just because they don't have a whole lot of dollars for travel.
But, right.
They do go locally both in the summer and throughout the school year into classrooms.
So insectambassadors@entomology.wisc.edu would be the email address to pursue someone for your club or organization.
Right, right.
insectambassadors@entomology.wisc.edu. Again, our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. We have lines open for you if you have questions for Phil Pelletieri, or you can use our email at talk@wpr.org. What did the gypsy moth results look like when summer was over?
Well, in some sense, the amount of defoliation that came out, especially in parts of the northeast part of the state, and even in parts of Dane and Columbia County, were higher than it's been. But then, you know, because of the rain experience we had, there was a lot of mortality of the gypsy moth larvae. So we had the damage, but before they can transform into the moths, they died because primarily of a fungus disease, but also because of a virus disease. And so there will be some areas that have to be sprayed. That's pretty much the norm. But it could have been a lot worse. And as I said, I think what we witnessed around here is we got to about that second week of June and the population just crashed. But unfortunately, by that time, again, there were areas of oak trees that were defoliated.
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you also about another of the seasonal varieties of insect that would have been present this year, although I can't think of what it is right at the moment.
Japanese beetle or Asian?
Japanese beetles, that's right. That's one, the gardener's favorite insect.
Yeah, well, an interesting phenomena that we're watching, and honestly, some of this data comes to me from a colleague in soil science, Dr. Phil Barak, has been keeping trap catches in the west side of Madison. And I've noticed, you know, we've had Japanese beetle in our neighborhood for well over 10 years. And in the last 3 to 4 years, there has continually been a significant drop. And with Phil's data, what we can show is a 50% reduction each of the last 4 years in the population, which is very encouraging because that insect can be just such a bother. And this is a phenomenon we have seen in other states where it seems when the insect first gets established, it causes the most damage. But then after 4, 5, 7 years, somewhere in that neighborhood, it starts to come into some more of a balance. It doesn't go away completely, but as I said, instead of catching 12,000 in his trap, he's only catching 1,000. That is really remarkable reductions in population. But what we continue to see is it's moving into new areas. And so up in the Appleton area, up in the Green Bay area, you know, up in the western side of the state, they've already made it up into Barron County, which is really quite disappointing. So for people who have not seen it, it's kind of like climbing a hill. When it gets there, it will start as a trickle. Within 2 to 3 years, it will be quite numerous, but then hopefully they'll see a similar phenomena that the populations will start to decline over a period of time.
We have a caller from Tomahawk who is interested in tarantulas, and that would be Pat. Hi, Pat. What's on your mind today?
Good morning. I manage a pet store in Tomahawk. My question is that we have a 20-foot tiger retic we use, and we have an alligator, we have a big sulcata tortoise we use for educational purposes, and I've been wanting to bring in a tarantula just because the kids are very attracted to it. My question is that we get a lot of tarantulas in, and we do sell them, but they seem to be jumpy, and I'm assuming it's because of the attention, it's because of the shipping. What can I do, or how can I calm them down? And I guess the next question would be is, I know that they do sting. I said, I'm just for insurance purposes, what do I look for if it does seem to get violent or where it doesn't want to be on a child or an adult? I guess those are questions. Yeah. And if you want, I'll just listen on the air and write down the answers.
Well, I mean, to me, again, individual species have temperaments, but also individual spiders have temperaments. And you will find some that just don't tolerate a whole lot of activity. One of the interesting things about tarantulas, I think the common human nature when you have something in your hand is to pet it. And you can't do that with tarantulas because literally the hairs on their body are almost like the hairs on a nettle plant. They will work up into like little slivers into your hand. And so, people have to get past that idea. When you start looking at their posturing, you can get an idea of when they're happy and they're just walking, or when they start to get agitated and they start to raise the front pair of legs and get ready to pounce. And so reading that, but unfortunately, if you had one in your hand, I think the average person that saw that kind of aggressive behavior would probably kind of throw it. And so, as I said, unless you've worked with a lot of spiders and you have one that has a good temperament, I'm not so sure it's a critter that you want just the general public to handle. People that keep them for pets, I think, over time get to read them and the spider gets used to the handling. And so they individually can work with them quite easily. But as I said, this was kind of unusual, the one particular specimen that we had that was just so tolerant of activity and never, ever, ever had any inclination that the spider was interested in biting somebody.
Thank you for your call, Pat. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Mark next in Racine. Hi, Mark. What's on your mind today?
Mark in Green Bay?
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, I was wondering about dragonfly migrations. I saw a thing in the National Geographic that talked about the common green darner dragonfly flying, I think it's 1,200 miles on the East Coast. And this year, for the first time in the 35 years we've been along the shore of Green Bay, we saw thousands and thousands of them over the same route that the swallows were taking, which I thought was pretty inopportune for the dragonfly. But is there a migration on dragonflies here in the Midwest?
We do get green darners, what I was always taught, coming out of Kentucky and the like, but we do have breeding populations. The thing this year that we did get a number of calls on are congregations of dragonflies other than that species, and I'm not so sure that was necessarily migration. There's other things, feeding activity and the like that come into play, but definitely we do get, how you can tell the difference between the natives and the migrants really is the maturity. And when we start getting adult dragonflies up here quite early, those ones have to come up. And again, usually we figured it's the central part of the U.S. is where they are coming from. It's interesting, some of those populations out east going farther distances, I think, they basically have to go far enough south that they can survive. Although, they said, in ponds and whatnot, we do get them. They just develop slower up here because of the coolness.
Well, these were the last 2 weeks of September and the first week of October, and they're fully, full adults. And they were mainly flying in the evening, and they were always heading south, so it looked like a migration to me.
And did they look like green darners, or could you not quite tell?
No, they were, as far as I know, they were just the common type that we have around here. Green darner didn't impress me one way or the other.
Okay, because, we have some smaller, but not that much smaller, dragonflies with banded wings and other patterns. Green darners have that, kind of bluish in the front and in the green abdomen, and So they're quite distinctive. You get to see them, and it is the largest dragonfly that we've got.
But as far as you know, there's no comparable migration route that follows the Great Lake.
Well, no, nothing like my monarchs and other things. As I said, we get some movement. In particular, this has been a curious year because dragonflies in general had a very good year. In fact, I know there were articles in the Milwaukee papers and whatnot with just people making those observations, and probably related to the rainfall patterns as much as anything else.
Mark, thanks very much for the call. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on the Ideas Network. Happy to have you with us as we talk about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. It's located on Linden Drive. And are people welcome to come and tour whatever they can find there at the lab?
Well, the lab itself is kind of a classic lab with things piled all over. We do have on the third floor of Russell Laboratories our insect research collection, and there are some display boards on the outside of a lot of big tropical critters, butterflies, beetles, that kind of thing. If there's a small group, the research collection really is not set up as a public museum. It is what it says, a research collection. So if you have a couple people that want to come in and look at things, it works quite well. A large group, it really doesn't, because, again, things are kind of narrow in there, and things are really not set out on display. They're put away in what we call Cornell drawers, which are the way that we store museum-type specimens. But, yeah, definitely, you know, we always tell people if you're down here, you know, have an ice cream at Babcock or whatnot, or visiting other things on the Ag campus, it's great to come across up on the third floor, and there's quite a bit of display stuff there. There's a little bit of stuff in the lobby, too, but that would be the best place to look. So,
let's go back to the phones, Phil, and we'll go to Harvey in Racine. Hello, Harvey.
Hi. My question for Phil is, I've collected insects as a kid. I'm now 74 years old and typically picked up a few Cecropia cocoons and stuff and hung them up to watch them for the kids hatch and stuff like that. Is there some plague that's hit them, or are somebody's parasitic wasps doing damage to them? Because I haven't seen cocoons around for the last 5 years or so.
I mean, a high percentage of Cecropias have parasites in them, and we don't see the problem quite as severe as they do out east, but out in New York and whatnot, in Central Park, Cecropias disappeared completely. And so the question was asked why. Some people speculated that maybe indeed that was because of too much light competition and the like. But what turned out to be a major component of this is a parasitic fly that was brought in to control gypsy moth. The species is Compsellura. And out there, it absolutely devastated the populations. It definitely has an impact in Wisconsin, but we still see Cecropias here. But I would agree with you. They're not as common as they used to be, and this seems to be one of the major reasons why, is that some of these parasites that were brought in for controlling some pests, unfortunately, had a broad host range, and they are getting, in this case, an on-target species that they're affecting.
So are they still are also hitting the other so-called giant silk moths around here?
Yeah, you know, the other ones aren't quite as common. You know, Polyphemus is probably the second most common. Luna, you know, up in the northern part of the state and parts of the Kettle Moraine, you can find it. I've never seen a Luna in Madison, although I've seen it outside of Madison. It's interesting that we're starting to get imperial moths up in this part, which is a yellowish wild silkworm that normally, even though it feeds on oak, we always used to feel it couldn't overwinter here because of the cold temperatures. But because of the lack of cold temperatures, it's one of these insects that is moving in. So imperial moths, when I was a kid, I would have given you my bike to get one. Now, again, I see a handful of specimens each year come into the lab.
Well, thank you.
All right, Harvey, thank you very much for the call. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri. Mike emails from Algoma and said this past summer was unusually wet, so I expected an abundance of earwigs. Instead, I was pleasantly surprised to see very few. Is he wrong in associating humid conditions with higher populations of earwigs?
No, I usually correlate wet springs with lots of earwig activity. It depends where you were in the state. The northwestern part of the state where earwigs are relatively new, people probably experienced bad populations for the first time ever. Down in the Madison area where we've had them for 20 years plus, Again, I was anticipating a little bit higher numbers. I mean, there were earwigs out there, but nothing real crazy. And again, you go back to this common trait that when insects first establish, exotic insects first establish, they're more problematic, but over time, things tend to balance. So I think that has something to do with it. That being said, I think a real dry spring, I would not expect earwigs. They come out of the ground as partially grown nymphs about the time of the Memorial Day holiday. And again, if things are really dry, things get kind of tough on them. But if things are really lush, they tend to do pretty well.
And let's go to Jim in Van Dyne next. Jim, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have run across something that has eaten the leaves off of plum plants, and this year I found it on my grape vines. This worm is about a half inch in diameter and almost 2.5 inches long. It has ranged in color from light green to a light brown, and I thought there can't be many of these. Maybe you have some idea. I also have a small second question, if you can answer this.
Okay. Did you said up to 2 inches? Did they ever get bigger than that?
Oh, I've seen them. 2.5 to 3 inches in length.
Okay. I'm suspicious it's a type of Pandora sphinx moth. And Pandora, it doesn't have the horn that you see on a lot of the sphinx or hawk moths. It has a little eye spot if you look at it quite closely on the posterior end. So that would be my first guess. They will get upwards of 3 inches plus, and then they burrow down in the ground to transform. So you don't see cocoons per se. They have pupal cases in the ground. But they love grape. They will spill over to some other things, but grape is the main host.
Okay, that sounds great.
All right. Yes, Jim, your second question.
Second question is, I've got ash trees and probably some elm that are dying here, and what I find inside is a wax worm that is about 1/4 inch in diameter and probably an inch and a quarter in length. And I see this worm in quite a few trees as I'm cutting up the dead trees.
Okay, did they have a definitive head, or do you just see a little bit of a brownish jaws on the critter?
I've never noticed the head. They have segments kind of like the Michelin tire.
Sure.
Thing.
They belong to a group that we call the longhorn wood borers, which are common. I mean, I often call these firewood insects in the sense that they attack dead and dying trees. The larvae develop. Sometimes when people store wood in their house, then they get the adults coming out, and they tend to be kind of cockroach-like in appearance, very long antennae, long, thin type of creatures. But they don't pose any problem to any structural wood because they can't attack seasoned dry wood. They basically just attack dead trees. And there are a number of species of cerambycid. So you could have, in fact, even 4 or 5 species even out of one type of wood. That's not uncommon. So
they're not killing the tree, then it's something else that's killing the tree.
Right. They basically are, we would call, secondary. They move in. I don't know. There is a round-headed apple tree borer that we occasionally see cause some trouble on apples and whatnot that is pretty aggressive. But as a family and as a group, as they said, they're basically attacking dead and dying trees.
I'm quite sure that I have seen this emerald ash borer here, too.
Now, what county are you in?
I'm in Winnebago County.
Okay, you're close enough too, although, the thing, we have a student working on the genus that the emerald ash borer is in, and just kind of doing a survey. There is 54 species he has identified in the genus Agrylis in Wisconsin alone, so we got a ton of lookalikes. Maybe not quite as green as the emerald ash borer and the like. The definitive thing on your dead ash trees would be either the D-shaped holes, or somebody taking a look at the trails that the larvae leave behind, because those are both characteristic and would confirm it. And since Winnebago is not officially a county, if you see any signs of that, we would love to have somebody who knows what they're looking at take a look, whether it's Department of Ag, DNR, or, you can send me pictures or specimens. I'd be happy to take a peek.
Well, let me do some close looking.
All right, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri, our resident entomologist here at the station. And, Phil, there was a question from Robert who emails about the usually very large numbers of ladybugs, apparently non-native varieties, for which many years have infiltrated their house. It's an old house in the fall. This year he's only seen a few. Mm-hmm. Though they're inconvenient indoors, are they beneficial for the gardens?
Oh, they are beneficial, but not so much for the gardens. The multicolored Asian lady beetle tends to forage more out in trees, so we get a lot of benefit there where it feeds on aphids and scales. It also likes to feed in soybean fields on the aphids associated with soybean that have come in the state in the last decade or so. But they don't hang around in gardens. In fact, they don't compete much with some of our native species in certain environments. But they're very beneficial. They're also relatively long-lived. The adults have been documented to live 2 to 3 years, which really is quite phenomenal for an insect. And I would agree, you know, the fall complaints that we normally get were dramatically down. I remember 10 years ago, one year my phone went dead because I couldn't put it down long enough to get recharged battery one of the days when the Asian lady beetles were flying and causing major problems. So, I go back to the comment I had made about invasives, that it seems to be balancing out over time, which is good, because we know that a lot of our native lady beetle species have been documented to suffer dramatically once the Asian lady beetle moved in.
Robert also wonders if the warm October could be blamed for their scarcity.
No, really it probably should have made it worse. What I tend to find is the trigger is the first hard freeze, and then the beautiful warm days after that is when they start to come in. And so we had the conditions that there was a number of nice days after the first hard freeze that they should have been congregating and trying to squeeze in the houses, and they weren't. I've seen other years where we've had the hard freeze and then it never warmed up, and then we blamed it on the lack of warm weather. So of anything, as I said, I would have thought this should have been a very good year for them. But we kind of had a hint, you know, looking in the soybean fields and whatnot, that there weren't as many out there as there have been in years, you know, 8, 9 years ago.
Let's go to Kevin in Tomahawk next about deer ticks. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. As a kid in the 60s, I don't remember deer ticks being around. You know, you had the wood ticks, and once it warmed up, they pretty much left. And I was just curious if they migrated in, or and will they migrate out?
Well, no, they're not going to migrate out. You know, it's a really unanswered question of how they got here. The first records that we have were in the late 1960s when we had a graduate student pick up the first deer tick up in the Spooner area on a mouse. And he published a paper on that. And this is before Lyme disease was recognized as a problem. And so we saw it spread from there. And there were tick surveys done in the state back in the 50s, and there were no deer ticks picked up at that time. From that point, we had seen the migration primarily south. So the northwest or the western side of the state, the west central part of the state, is the one that's had deer ticks the longest and the heaviest populations. One of the things that we're witnessing now is a slow establishment on the eastern side of the state. And so, you know, we have records, I think, officially in every county other than Racine, and we might even have records there. I just haven't been watching that as close. And they've spilled into Illinois, northern Illinois. So the big question is, were they here before? There's a similar story out east where the first records were back in the 30s on some islands off of Connecticut, and then the movement came in and the like. There are records of this tick down in Texas and elsewhere where they call it the black-legged tick. That's why the student published on it, because it was so out of range. And some people have speculated it has to do with deer densities, that the deer densities were too low to support large numbers of ticks, and now the deer densities are high enough that it can. But we really don't have a clear picture of how it got here. And it's been interesting to watch the last 30 years or so its movement in. I would say it's been slower than you might think, but now in particular, again, the thing that we've been quite curious about is the populations in Sheboygan and in Walworth counties and some of the southeast where they were not before. They definitely were seeing ticks now, and in fact, a couple of my colleagues are tracking that pretty closely.
And let's go to Roman in Wausau next. Hi, Roman.
Hi, good morning. Two things. We've been keeping house for 60 years and never encountered or even knew there was such a thing as pantry moths or kitchen moths, whatever you call them. We apparently had some open dog food or flour or something that had been sitting around a while, and these pesky little things, we found some traps for them, and we learned that, I guess, peppermint and bay leaves are things that kind of keep them away, but you may have some additional hints how we can get rid of those. But another thing, we're taking a trip this winter to Florida. And if is there any kind of organic, like these peppermint and bay leaves, that we could put in our luggage or something that would keep bed bugs from traveling back with us? Any hints you can give us in that direction would be
Yeah, sure. No, there are no repellents I've seen for bed bugs yet, unfortunately. The one piece of advice there is they honestly are selling suitcase cookers. They're basically units you put a suitcase in. This would be if you traveled a lot. And you turn it up because you can kill a bed bug at 112 degrees. And but so far there are no repellents. You just got to be careful when you take your suitcase. If you're staying in hotels, I would suggest that you keep the suitcase in the bathroom, maybe even the bathtub. That's very unlikely for bed bugs to be there, and so you're not going to pick them up. The problem is if you put the suitcase under the bed or close to the bed, there is an opportunity for the bed bugs to transfer. Now, as far as the pantry moths, Indian meal moth is the most common. It tends to come in on pet food, but also on people food. And what is frustrating is that they lay their eggs, and you often find, although you brought them in on one package, before time they get into all kinds of dry goods, noodles, rice, nut meats, chocolates, raisins. They also can breed on spices, dried flour arrangements. And so what I find when they get introduced into a house, most people are just chasing them around. And it's something I don't have as much confidence in the bay leaves and the like. We have found that really isn't that strong of a repellent. What we have to suggest when people have the problem is to go through the dry goods, throw out what they know is infested, and then to take other items that you don't go through in a 2 or 3 week period of time and seal them in a container that the insect cannot get access to. So, plastic, Tupperware type things, screw top jars, even some of the plastic containers you buy for storing food works quite well. What doesn't work is a baggie. I mean, there's just not enough substrate there, and there also is usually enough openings that the insects can come and go quite easily. And so it's all about sanitation. What I always tell people, this is something that I'm really not crazy about spraying for, because if you've got a bad box of Bisquick, you can spray all you want, you still got bugs. Whereas if you get rid of the Bisquick and or whatever's infested and make sure that they can't get in new food access, that in itself will be a solution. And the other good news about the pantry moths is they don't feed on clothing, so they're not like a clothes moth. They're basically just a pest of dried plant material. So that could be spices. It could be food products. It also could be a dried flower arrangement. So you have to be careful. Sometimes people don't think about our potpourri, to be honest, because it's the leaves or the flower petals of something. That indeed could be a food source for them.
We're talking with Phil Pelletieri about bugs and insects, and if you have a question, give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to John in Cross Plains next. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Phil, I have an observation here I've been making. I live out in a rural area, and it's been several years since I've seen a lubber grasshopper, and all of the orthops, grasshoppers, and crickets, I see a fairly good population reaching about half, maybe their third instar or so, and then they don't seem to be there in the fall. I don't know whether it's a fungus disease or what, but I haven't heard a cricket chirping in my basement for 3 years, and they used to be really invade.
The widespread of it, definitely wet years promote fungus diseases, and there are definitely some fungus diseases that are tough on the grasshoppers and the like. And it's been wet. When we're thinking of the destructive grasshoppers, usually what gets us in trouble is dry springs, because when the eggs hatch, the first and second instars survive real well. If it's real wet, they kind of drown, is what we often thought. But it's interesting, the broader observation, sometimes we used to equate some of these things, especially in rural areas, to a large amount of chemical use for growing corn and the like. And it's interesting now with this genetically modified corn, we're honestly using a lot less insecticide, a lot less of these soil insecticides that sometimes would get us in trouble. So of anything, you would have thought with reduced chemical use that if that indeed was the culprit, that things should be getting better, not worse. So maybe it's just an artifact, John, of just the weird weather the last couple, 3 years, because it hasn't been on the wet side. But, what I am seeing is this interesting phenomena of things that were not found in Wisconsin, when I first started, now appearing here because of the milder winter. So we have praying mantises in particular. And it wouldn't surprise me if we really looked at the Orthoptera that there's probably a handful of species that we thought more southern have kind of moved in. But other than that, as I said, that's an interesting observation. I heard decent crickets this year, both tree crickets and field crickets. But I do at times get people giving me interesting observations of, just like you said, kind of a interesting phenomena where things have just disappeared and we really don't know quite why.
I know the lubber grasshoppers used to be very common, and boy, I haven't seen one. And last year, I don't think I saw a garden spider all year.
Yeah, well, I had a great late season orb web spider. You know, the various types, whether the barn spiders or the black and yellow Argiopa or whatnot. They seem to have a good year, at least from the kind of specimens people sent me.
John, thank you very much for your call, and appreciate hearing from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Dan in Elkhorn sent us an email saying that last fall he caught in his basement what he believes is a leaf-footed bug. It was about an inch or so long. What happened was that he cupped the insect in his closed hand, carried him up the stairs to let him go free outdoors. On the way up, he bit me. Mm. What I can't find out about is my reaction to his bite. It smarted at first, but for the next 10 minutes, the pain at the site burned and kept increasing to the point I would compare it to a wasp sting, but not stinging, but burning. What is known about this insect and his bite?
Well, you know, my first question, everything was making sense till the bite. The leaf-footed bug that comes in our house is called the western conifer seed bug, and it feeds on pine and spruce seeds. And it has a very distinctive odor when you handle it, and it does like to come in the house like a box elder bug. When I hear where he got bit and the reaction he had, that sounds more like an assassin bug or something related to it. And we do have a number of close lookalikes that would be same shape, maybe same color, just not that flared last leg segment. In this, as I said, assassin bugs are predators. And when they bite, it does feel like a bee sting. They have salivary components they use to paralyze and digest their prey out of body. And so if you get enough of this in a given area, it can cause numbing, it can cause swelling. The thing about a leaf-footed bug being a plant feeder, it doesn't have those kind of components in its saliva. And I wouldn't say they couldn't bite because they have a beak-like structure, but one wouldn't expect much of a reaction other than being like pricked with a needle is what I would expect. So as I said, my first guess is it more likely is a species of assassin bug that got in the house that you were carrying rather than one of these plant-feeding leaf-footed bugs.
We're talking with Phil Pelletieri about bugs and insects, and we'll have more after a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network, and glad to have you along with us today. Dave Potratz is our on-air producer as we talk with Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the Madison campus, about bugs and insects. And Phil will go back to the phones with Sally in Wayland, Minnesota. Hello, Sally.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Phil. Only very occasionally I'll see a humming moth in my garden. And I always see them on butterfly bushes or buddleia. And I'd like to know what other plants could I put in my garden to attract these. They're so magical. You almost look around and start looking for fairies and leprechauns. How can I bring more?
Well, I'm not so sure. I have seen them on various plants, but, you know, their populations kind of ebb and flow. And to be honest, most of the flights are at night. And so I think people probably have more activity from them than they think. The one species that is inclined to feed in the day is the white-lined sphinx moth. And as I said, I think just about anything that's attractive to butterflies would be attractive to these hawk moths. And other than that, we had the earlier caller that was talking about the critter on grape. Well, that turns out to be a species of hawk moth, the Pandora sphinx. There are species on cherry trees and ash trees, on apple trees. As I said, it's a relatively big group. Most of the species are kind of a grayish drab, but we do have some that are really quite colorful with pinks and you know, yellows and the like. And most of the time when I get the call, it's kind of like you mentioned. I mean, people who have never seen one think maybe it's some kind of hummingbird because their behavior is very similar. But because they're flying at night, as I said, I've had my best luck at dusk. And I've had my best luck in the fall. And I think that's because in the case of the white line sphinx, that's often when we have a pretty strong flight of those moths. But you can try rearing them. You know, white line sphinx is such a generalist that you know, one of the things it feeds on is the weed purslane. So if you grew a lot of purslane, you would have a better chance of them laying eggs in developing. But you know, other than that, as I said, it's not a family that I've seen manipulates very well. You just get fortunate that every once in a while you get to see one flying, and as you say, it is really pretty special.
Sally, thank you very much for the call. And let's go to Scott next in Milwaukee. Hi, Scott. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. I had a question about a particular kind of spider that I'm not sure is native to Wisconsin.
Okay.
I have a tenant who is a nurse, and she recently told me that I have what she described as a recluse spider mm-hmm. in my garage. It seemed to have a particular web, funnel-shaped, kind of an open circle at the bottom where the spider resides. And I looked it up online, and it has a particular nasty bite. This yeah. nurse...
Yeah, no, but I'll tell you what I think is going on. Recluse is not officially recognized as being established in the state, and I've seen it a handful of times, but we have some very close lookalikes, and there is one that is called a funnel or grass spider, and I'm pretty sure that's what you have. They are the same color, the same shape. The way you would differentiate them is, first of all, if you ever got close enough to see the eyes, most of our spiders, including the grass spiders, have eight eyes in four pairs, really. What's distinctive about the recluse is it only has six eyes total, three pairs. One of the other distinctive things, and this is what people confuse sometimes, that the grass spiders have two black lines on their cephalothorax, basically their headish in chest area. The recluse has a violin, a dark violin, and it is a classic violin with a neck and the kind of sinuated body to it. And so, you know, when people send me what they think is recluse, probably 95% of the time it turns out to be the grass spiders, or we got a couple other brownish spiders in that same category. The other thing about recluse, it has almost become an urban legend, the bites and the severe ulcerations. And although there have been those kind of complications in Arkansas and places where the spider is found, in the normal range is about central Illinois. What has been found is about half the cases that were getting diagnosed in the emergency room were in states where the spider was not found. And that right away raises a red flag. And in Rick Vetter, who's a scientist out on the East Coast, or excuse me, the West Coast, has pretty much proven that a lot of what was diagnosed as recluse bites turns out to be this MRSA bacteria that causes a very similar type of ulceration. And so when you see some of these things on the Internet and whatnot about somebody getting a spider bite and that, you know, in 4 or 5 days their hand is eroded down to the bone, what we're finding, again, is a lot of those cases, they were probably misdiagnosed. And if you ever need a real good feel for the biology of the recluse and again, how this has kind of become such an urban legend, if you go to Rick Vetter's site at California Riverside, so just do a search under Rick Vetter and spiders, and you'll get his site. He has a number of papers he has published trying to bust the myth. And I remember one case in particular. He talked about a family down in St. Louis that moved in an old farmhouse, and they are found in that area. They made it a family project to catch the recluse spiders, and they were up well over 1,000 spiders in a 6-month period of time, and nobody ever got bit. And so, as I said, even the name really comes from the fact that they are pretty shy, and they usually are hiding out in places. And they talk about probably its favorite place to nest is an old shoebox. And so, as I said, it makes much more sense that what you saw was one of these agalenids, or what we would call a grass or funnel web spider.
Thanks very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Tab in Mazamani next. Hi, Tab.
Good morning. I have a hibiscus plant, and when we brought it in from outdoors, now the leaves are being eaten, and I can find some very tiny spider webs, but I can't really find or look at the spiders.
Now, we wouldn't expect spiders to cause it. Now, is it being eaten, like chewed with holes in it, or are they just turning brown and falling off?
Well, I tell you, both, Phil. Both. Some of the leaves are falling off and they're turning brown, and then some of the leaves have holes in them.
Okay, because My first worry when we bring plants in from outside at this time of the year is that we get a spider mite outbreak. And it's interesting because in the climate that you have outside, the spider mites tend not to be problematic. But when you bring them indoors and the humidities go down because we're starting to get the furnaces or wood burners going, that's the ideal conditions. And when spider mites attack, they will leave webbing. But if you looked at it, they would look like little yellowish pepper grains. I mean, the mites are very small. Sometimes it helps to shake the plant over a piece of white paper and see if the dust starts walking. If that's the case, that would help confirm it was spider mites. The other thing is, as they feed, it reminds me of taking a piece of sandpaper over the leaf. It tends to get all these little yellowish spots. We call the symptom stippling, and that's just physical injury to the leaf, and that's why it browns and dies, is it just desiccates. It can't hold moisture. But spider mites don't eat holes. They're basically sucking the juices, and I'm a little hard-pressed. You know, when I think of critters on hibiscus feeding, you know, I would worry about little caterpillars or something that should be visible, you know, big enough, or little beetles. And I really would go more towards the caterpillar type of creature than I would anything else. And now, if it is spider mites, they do sell an insecticidal soap that really is very effective. The one warning with the soap, though, is it only kills on contact and it doesn't kill the eggs. So to really sufficiently treat a plant is you have to treat it once and then come back about 10 days later and treat it a second time. And try to concentrate on the undersides of the leaves because that's where the little mites like to hang out. And you really do need quite good coverage.
So okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Sure. All right, Tab. Thank you very much for the call. The number for you to get your question answered, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, we take email at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Douglas in Milwaukee next. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
My question is, I got this little brown beetle. It's real tiny, and I had it in my condo before, and then I moved, bought a new place, and it followed me. I did find it in concentration in I had rice stored. I found it there in some dry goods, but I kind of find it all over the place. So when I eliminated those things, I found it stacked up in the pantry.
Mm-hmm.
I still have problems with it. I really just can't shake this little guy.
Well, you know, I'd be happy to take a look at it. I'm guessing it's sawtooth grain beetle or red flower beetle, which are two quite common critters that we get in stuff. And what I always tell people is that the beetles are quite long-lived. I mean, they'll go 6 months or more quite easily. But if you've not seen a reduction in the numbers after going through the cleanup, there's something that you're overlooking. I mean, there's no other explanation. Again, where you got to be careful of is that sometimes it's a non-food item. You know, the potpourri or the, you know, dried Christmas wreath made out of walnuts or whatnot would all be food substrates. The other thing you worry about is that you did throw out what's infested, but they've done an end run and found another package of something on you. And, you know, this could all trace back to one package of pancake batter type of thing. But the presence of the insects in numbers, you know, a week after going through the cleanup tells me, as I said, you really haven't got to the source. That there's some other source that's there.
Right. I mean, I dropped the numbers, but I still occasionally find them, you know what I mean, buzzing around. The light from a lamp, you know, when I watch TV, might attract one or two, you know what I mean? So,
Are you seeing them fly then, or are you just seeing them walk?
No, they're flying.
Okay, so never mind on the sawtooth or red flower beetle, because those are two species that don't. The one that does fly quite readily that does this is called a drugstore beetle. The only claim to fame there is it's even more inclined to get into spices. You know, hot peppers and all kinds of things. And so, as I said, you may have to look somewhere else. I also see it. Do you have a pet?
I've got fish.
Okay, no problem there. I see these quite commonly in pet food, you know, doggy bones and treats and that kind of thing. And, again, what happens sometimes is somebody forgets about a half a box underneath the sink, and that gets to be the whole source. But, you know, in these kind of cases, when we're not sure, you know, I'm more than happy to take a peek at the specimens. You can always bring them in the local extension office. But if it's flying, as I said, what that right away it eliminates about 90% of the grain pests, and I suspect you've got something that we call a drugstore beetle.
Right. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. And for people who would like to send pictures to you, what should they do?
Well, as long as it's clear enough to be able to discern what it is. The email address I have is Pellitte, it's P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E, at entomology is entomology.wisc.edu. And it's interesting because I know my colleague Brian Huddleston, who runs the plant disease lab, often is kind of handcuffed when you send him a picture of a dying plant because he can't see what he needs to. But of the email pictures and JPEGs that people send me, I probably can identify about 95% of what people send as long as the picture's got some clarity to it. And then if I can't, I can, you know, I will request a sample to go farther. Some things like flies and whatnot are really kind of difficult unless they're very distinctive to tell. But for a lot of other things, as I said, I really have, you know, I've teased my students once in a while that one of the greatest inventions in my career has been the digital camera, both from being able to take pictures, but the other side is sending specimens. And what I process now, it's getting up close to 40% of what I process are digital images rather than specimens.
And let me ask you this. If someone goes to your website, will they find a picture of a drugstore beetle?
Yes, that particular one. I do have an insect ID section. We have about 25,000 species of insects in the state, and I by no means have anything like that. But for the indoor stuff in particular, I'm pretty comfortable with the common things of having pictures of these things. They're little thumbnails, and you can blow them up, and then usually we will link you to some other extension information we have in regards to that particular creature.
We are talking with Phil Pelletieri, who is an entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us as we talk about bugs and insects with Phil Pelletieri of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Dave Potratz is our on-air producer today, and we'll take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. And Phil, let's go right to the phones and Lori in Horicon. Hi, Lori.
Hello there. I don't have a real interesting question, but I wondered if you have anything else to add on how to get rid of what I suspect is a gnat. I moved into a duplex in January, and throughout the winter, I kept noticing this tiny little, what I would call a gnat, flying, and you'd notice it in the bathroom and the living room. And I went through the usual routine that you've talked about, pantry plants. And then the interesting thing was when summer came, they were gone. I never saw them again. And then now that the cold weather is back, they're starting to return. We've tried pouring bleach down our drains because someone said maybe they were coming through there. Mm-hmm. Wondered if you have any other ideas of what we could do.
Well, to be honest, this would be one that would really, really be important to tell what it is, because gnat's kind of a generic term, and I have two or three thoughts. There is a drain fly that comes out of floor drains. Bleach doesn't take care of it because all that does is sterilize the inner part of or the outer surface of this scum that's built up, and that's what these things are in. I would try a hot pail of water. And aside from floor drains, I would check your bathroom overflow because that's often another place where they could potentially breed. But there are fungus gnats, there are, you know, fruit flies. I said there's three or four other things that the direction would be totally different. So I'd be more than happy. You got to be a little careful because I need something reasonably intact because I got to look at the wings and whatnot, but see what it is. How old is the duplex?
It's relatively new.
Okay. The other phenomena I have been seeing, which I'm not saying this is it, and that's why I want to see the critter, but the fungus gnats, although they breed in potting soil, also can breed any place else where you have an accumulation of wet organic matter. And I've seen cases where they've had straw or similar things that they're using when they're building, and rather than pulling it out when they're fixing, you know, putting the soil by the foundation, they bury it. And sometimes it even gets buried underneath the cement slab. Well, my insects can still breed there, and then what happens is they filter up through cracks and whatnot into the living structure. And so that's another potential scenario, but that's why I say it's really probably worth just sending some critters off to me. And then once we know for sure, at least I think I can point you in a more specific direction. The address here for specimens is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. And the university zip is 53706. And if you just send us the insect lab, I'll get it. And then if you've got a phone number or email, I'll get back to you as quick as I can.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And good luck to you, Lori. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's try Julian in Milwaukee. Hello, Julian.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling because about 6 weeks ago, I came across a really large insect in the east side of Milwaukee. I later identified it as a giant water bug.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of confused because I've lived in Milwaukee most of my life and never heard of a water bug until I moved to Kansas City for a period of time. And then now I come back here and I find out that we have one of the largest water bugs that there are.
Sure.
So I want to know a little bit more about those. And then also, what are their links to cockroaches?
Right. That's where I was going to go, because in some parts of the country, oriental cockroaches are called water bugs, and it's a totally different animal. The giant water bug is a true bug. It is an aquatic insect. It typically lives in lakes, in ponds, and the like, where it is a predator on small insects and fish. But they also sometimes, when I was a student, my professor called them, as a common name, giant electric light bugs, because they are attracted to lights at night. We get complaints also for people who have pools that they'll come in and try to move into the pool. But what happens in the fall of the year in particular is they often will migrate from the smaller water sources to bigger water sources that aren't going to freeze. So it's not unusual to have them flying around, and I probably see the most specimens coming in during September and early October. They're relatively common throughout the state, but unless you were sampling in ponds looking for them, you're probably not going to see them, because they do spend most of their time in the water. And as I said, this, you know, common name of calling them water bugs, and this is truly a true water bug, whereas a cockroach is not a true bug. It's a cockroach. It's a very different animal. But in some parts of the country, it said water bug is a common term, just like palmetto bug is a common term in parts of the country for the big American cockroaches.
And thank you very much for your call, Julian. Thanks. Appreciate it. And on to Erica in Milwaukee. Erica, what's on your mind today?
I'm just calling. I found a very interesting caterpillar, and I'm assuming that it was into a moth on my tomato plant this year. It was huge. I would say it was at the very least 4 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
It was very green. Had lots of spikes on it.
Right. And that is, you know, we were talking earlier, the person that was interested in hawk moths. This is another species of hawk moth, or they call them hornworms. And there is both a tomato and tobacco hornworm. We tend to get more of the tomato species here than we do the tobacco. They feed on, in this case, relatively selective plants in the solanaceous family. And tomato fits in that category. And then when they're done feeding, they burrow in the ground, and they transform into this dark chestnutty-colored 3.5-inch-long pupal case, and that's how they get through the winter. And in the spring of the year, when the soil warms up, the moths emerge and fly. But they fly at night, typically. They remind people of hummingbirds. They're very quick in the way they feed. And if you were to capture one or look closely, their proboscis is coiled up underneath their head. And their proboscis can extend upwards of about 2.5 to 3 inches. And that's what they do, is they hover in front of the flower, and then they extrude their proboscis in to feed on nectar. And one particular larvae on a tomato plant can cause a lot of damage because they're eating about 3 to 4 times their body weight a day in food. So when it's a 4-inch caterpillar, that's a lot of tomato. They'll even feed into the fruit once in a while. You get a big gouge into it. But typically the numbers are low enough in this state that when you see them, you can just hand pick them. You know, it really is not problematic. Now, in some of the southern states, this gets to be quite common, and to the point that they have to spray to prevent problems. But up here, it's really more of a curiosity, I would think, for most of us.
So it would be okay to, like, if it would come back next year, I have an 8-year-old daughter, and she thought it was very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day it was just gone, so that must have been...
Yeah, that's when it probably went. So, you know, what you could do, you know, if you wanted her to observe the life cycle is to bring a few fresh leaves in every day, let it feed, and then provide it with some kind of, you know, vermiculite or loose soil so that when it's finally maturing, it will burrow underneath and transform. But then the other trick, if it's the middle of summer, you can let it go and it will probably still come out. But if you see something like this in August or early September, the best thing to do is to take it once it burrows in the ground and put it in a very cool basement, or you can leave it out in the garage and let it go through the normal cooling process, the normal warming up in the spring, and then when it finally does emerge in May or early June, if your daughter has an interest, she can let it go. If you bring it inside, sometimes these insects won't develop if they don't get a cold shock, or if they do develop, then you've got an adult moth that emerges in November and December, and then it's really not fair to let it go outside.
Right. Thank you very much.
All right, Erica, thank you so much. And again, the number for you, if you have a question for Phil, is 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Tom in Green Bay for more on the dragonflies.
Yes, I hate to go back to something you already covered, but you made the comment that there is not a predictable migration of the green darters. And
No, that's not. I was saying that we do have green darters that migrate. I just don't see the kind of migrations like monarchs that are just very predictable and the like.
Okay. I've been involved in hawk trapping on Lake Michigan and up on the west shore of Green Bay for over 35 years. And there is every late August through September and a little bit into October, you have periods of just massive movements.
Mm-hmm.
And these things, the fellow asking about the swallows don't take them. However, things like merlins, male peregrines will catch them and eat them on the wing. In some days, in late September, when you have a lot of thermals, these things actually end up in the thermals with the kettles of broadwings, and you can sit there and watch broadwings catch them and eat them on the wing while they're flying. But there is, having taken literally thousands of these things out of our mist nets we run are 16 feet high,
mm-hmm.
and I tell you, man, there's a migration.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And do you find it pretty much is just green darter, or do you get mixed species?
No, there's other ones mixed in, too, but mainly mm-hmm. green darters.
Okay, well, that definitely would verify. And you know, you see that lake effect with a lot of insects. It's really quite amazing. You know, even up in Door County, we sometimes get records of things that just don't belong here, and you wonder again if it's just the way that the wind patterns and whatnot cause. We had a couple specimens of very rare hawk moths show up this year, and usually when we see them, it's along the lakeshore rather than in the interior part of the state, and I wonder if that has an awful lot to do with it.
Well, what happens if you look at your weather patterns? In June, July, first part of August, you have basically a southerly wind flow. And then this slowly switches over to west, and then finally by November, December, we're getting the northwesters coming in. And this has great effects like in hawk migration. And all of the redtails, the young redtails that we catch in August, in the first part of September, are born south of us. We have birds. Redtails typically go back and nest where they were born, where they hatched, okay? And they usually within 50, 60, 70 miles of where they were hatched is where they're going to try to nest as an adult. And if you take a look at our distribution pattern for young redtails caught in August and September, they are all south of us in between Madison, Milwaukee, northern Illinois, Indiana. And those birds get drifted up in those winds. And if they get drifted up, I see no reason that insects don't get drifted up, too.
Mm-hmm.
And everything just comes up here. And then when you start having fall migration and weather, west winds and northwest winds, the stuff starts moving south, gets drifted to the water, and comes right down the shoreline.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks much for sharing that.
Yes, Tom, thank you so much. We appreciate the information that you've provided today. Talking with Phil Pelletieri about bugs and insects, and Steve is next in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Several years ago, I awakened with apparently a bite on my forehead, and this has just bugged me for several years. Maybe you can help me. It was a triangular bite, equilateral kind of triangle with each leg being about an eighth of an inch. And it swelled up, red pustules, and just through simple home care, it went away after a couple of weeks. However, it left a scar. There are three dimples on my forehead now. And at the time, I worked with physicians, and they all were curious, and they all looked at it, and their diagnosis was, well, I don't think you'll die, and they were all correct because I didn't. I happened to have an appointment with my physician. He looked at it. He didn't know. He called in a dermatologist. He didn't know. I'm just curious, do you have any idea what might leave a mark like that?
Well, yeah, bites are always so difficult to go with. I mean, the only thing that I find is pieces of evidence that at least lean us in a direction is that if it was a spider bite, under close examination, you often can see two fang marks, because that's the way spiders have. They have two fangs that they feed on. If it was a single puncture hole, then we get back to things like assassin bugs and other true bugs. And, you know, the reactions for any of these bites, if it is truly arthropod-caused, is, you know, they have very interesting enzymes, being predators. And if they get enough of those enzymes in you and you have tissue that's sensitive, you can have tissue damage. Now, a cluster of bites, you know, that's more typical of something that doesn't like the way you taste, you know, things like fleas and the like, but you just don't see those kind of dramatic reactions to a flea bite. It's, you know, more like a mosquito bite. So I'm not so sure I can give you other than a guess. And as I said, without knowing if there was under close examination a single or a double puncture mark, and if there were no puncture marks, you start to worry about, is it some kind of odd infection or something that you can't, you know, quite tell? And it's very, very difficult to tell the difference, you know, unless somebody does an assay of some sort or a culture of some sort to see. And we do even find in some cases that things that start as arthropod bites tend to pick up some infections, and the complication is the infection, not the bite itself. So I'm really a little hard-pressed. And as I always tell people, you know, if you have a bite on your forearm and you show it to somebody, I don't know anybody that I consider enough of an expert that by looking at the bite alone can give you more than an educated guess. And the educated guess really comes more from where were you, when did it happen, all those other kind of things, so that you're kind of getting data that would suggest one thing over another. But it is interesting. Was it right on the hairline?
Yes, it was. It was just below the hairline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could not rule out, you know, most of the time people think they get spider bites. It's not. But that would be the closest thing I would think of, the way it reacted. But as I said, I it's not definitive by any means.
So there's nothing that you know of that would leave a triangular bite?
No, nothing has mouth parts like that.
Okay. Well, that narrows it down.
Good luck, Steve, on your search for the bug. Appreciate hearing from you. The number for you is 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri. And we'll go next to Patty in Menominee. Hello, Patty.
Hi. Last summer, my son found about an inch-long green caterpillar. It was about as thick as my pinky finger, with a blue horn in the middle of its head. And he collects bugs and was just wondering what that could be.
Okay. Single horn or multiple horns?
It just had a single horn.
Okay, and so I'm guessing what you think is the head is the back end.
Okay.
but small blue. I wonder if it's a snowberry sphinx. In the hornworm group, we have a couple species that look like bumblebees when they fly. They're colored like a bumblebee. They're the size of a bumblebee. They're feeding during the day. And there's one species in particular that would kind of fit that description that we find on honeysuckle. And so I'm just wondering if it was a somewhat small, they'll get a little bit bigger, they'll get closer to 2 inches before they're full grown, but they're definitely small for what a normal hawk moth is, because most of the species are quite a bit larger. So clearwing hawk moth or snowberry hawk moth is the couple names, and it might be worth him doing a Google image search just for, you know, caterpillar of in one of those and just see what he comes up with.
Because he tried to store it, and there's not much left.
Yeah. And, you know, and it gets tough with caterpillars because, you know, we literally have probably, even in the larger moths and butterflies, we're talking 3,000 or so species, and there isn't a lot of good help in identifying them, although there was a book that came out about 4 years ago called Caterpillars of the Eastern North America that, to me, was just exquisite, and it doesn't have everybody in there, but it has a lion's share. So it's a field guide series out of Princeton University, and it's relatively inexpensive. I think I only paid about $19, but if somebody has a lot of interest in identifying caterpillars, that definitely would be the book that I would recommend to them.
Well, thank you.
All right, Patty, good luck to you. And let's go to Nick in Green Bay. Nick, what's on your mind today?
I just had a quick question. I was just inquiring, because everybody keeps telling me this, and I know. They keep saying that Lyme disease is a man-made disease, that the government made it for, say, combat operations. I was just wondering what your hypothesis is on that.
Wayne, that Lyme disease is a human made disease.
Yeah, they're going to make it for like put it on the combat field and get all the troops sick, and then that way, you know,
no,
they can't really fight.
What it's interesting, you know, I always tell people this is one of the most curious things for me to watch in my career, because as a student you hear about all these arthropod diseases, malaria and whatnot, but they're in places away. But Lyme disease has been unfolding in Wisconsin during my career, and both Lyme disease, human anaplasmosis, and babesiosis are mouse diseases, are rodent diseases. And what the tick is a bridge. And it feeds on an infected mouse, and then when it feeds on a human the next time it feeds, that's how you get the transmission. So that seems to be pretty clear. And it's interesting that there's even a couple unnamed diseases that we know are following a similar pattern. And the important thing is that the tick is the bridge. The tick is the way that it moves from rodents to people. And so to me that seems pretty clear. And now the problem with Lyme disease is it's not the most easy thing to diagnose. And so there's a lot of problems there, and some people got diagnosed that maybe didn't. Some people have other Lyme-like diseases, you know, so it really gets quite complicated when you look at the broader biology of it, but it definitely appears to be, again, a rodent disease that the tick is the carrier in mover from one animal to the next, because we get Lyme disease in dogs, and it's the same story. The tick had fed on an infected rodent, then feeds on your dog, and then your dog can contract Lyme disease.
Okay.
All right, Nick, thanks very much. Good luck to you. Have a good weekend. And let's try Bill in Wautoma next. Hi, Bill.
How are you today?
Good. Thank you.
I was stationed on Fort Knox, Kentucky, I want to say a year and a half, maybe 2 years back. And when I went out to start my car in the morning, there was, I'm guessing it's a type of housefly that was paired up, and they appeared to be mating on the hood of my car. And I thought, you know, you two get a room. And I started the car up. And another pair of very similar-looking houseflies landed on the same part of my hood and turned the same direction as the other two. And they then again started mating. And upon putting the car in park, or in gear, rather, another pair who were already connected in mid-flight landed in the same section of my hood and turned the same direction. I have a picture of this, and it just seemed odd to me. Have you ever seen any type of behavior like this in houseflies?
No, although, you know, my first thought is that there's so many other flies that look like houseflies. I'm not sure it's a housefly, but I can't even tell you that behavior of any flies. You know, I don't know if it had something to do with the color reflection from the hood was attracting, but that still wouldn't explain why they all lined up in one particular direction. So I'm really not sure I have a good explanation. Be happy to look at the picture. I mean, if you got a decent picture, just to see if I can, you know, to really tell it's a housefly, we got to see what the wing venation looks like and whatnot. But as they said, it may just ring a bell as something else, but I'm still not so sure that's going to explain what the little stinkers were doing.
Okay, I kind of figured that would be a stumper. It just seemed very odd to me that, you know, at the same time in the same place, facing the same direction, doing the same thing. It was just kind of weird to me.
Well, it is the military around there. Perhaps they'd been watching.
Perhaps, yes.
Bill, thank you very much for the call. Dennis, we've got time for one quick solution to Asian beetles.
Okay, I've actually, on the Japanese beetle, I just wanted to mention, hello?
Yes,
go ahead, but okay, you've got to speed this up.
Okay, on the Japanese beetle, one of the remedies that I have come up with because of my vegetable garden is I take cheesecloth, I tie some lines to it with some washers, I lay it over top of my hibiscus that are next to my vegetables, and put it on in the heat of the day when the Japanese beetle are around. They don't bother at all. I take it off in the evening, wait till the heat of the day, and put it back on again. It's a little bit of labor. However, it seems to work pretty well, and then I can eat my vegetables whenever I'd like.
Yeah, great solution. They also sell a product called Rime, which is like a cheesecloth. That's made. It's an insect barrier, so it would work in a similar manner.
Dennis, thanks very much for the call. I'm sorry we are not going to be able to get to Margie or to Bill, but we've run out of time. Again, Phil, thank you so much for spending the hour and a half with us today.
Glad to help out, Jim.
Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus at 1630 Linden Drive in Madison. If you want to send something to him, email. It's pellittee@entomology.wisc.edu. Tomorrow, the birds of Wisconsin and elsewhere with Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and Bill Volkert of the DNR stationed at the Horican Marsh. Thanks for listening.